Pop Health Podcast is brought to you by 24 Hour Home Care. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Pop Health Podcast. This is your host, Zach Morgan. I'm really happy you're here with me today. I'm excited to share with you a great episode. I was recently invited as a guest to the USC Center for Body Computing annual conference. It was a really interesting gathering of minds who are exploring some of the new frontiers of the intersection of tech and life. Everything from healthcare to sports to use within the military or aging. There were some really interesting topics covered from not only the new technology that's coming and is on the horizon, but also things like data security and data ownership. I'm going to be sharing a series of interviews with you today, starting with Joe Perez, the co-founder of Tastemade and one of the board members of the Center of Body Computing. I really hope you enjoy it. Joe, thanks so much for sitting down with me today at the conference. It's been great so far this morning. First of all, can you tell the audience a little bit about your background? You have quite an interesting path to where you've gotten here.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me. Yeah, so I started my career back in Silicon Valley in the 90s in the first dot-com kind of wave, and spent the first 10 years of my career in online video games, which I think you'll, as we go through my background, you'll start to see why that's important to what we're doing today here at the USC Center for Body Computing. In addition to being on the board of the Center for Body Computing, I'm currently a co-founder of a company called Tastemade, and what we do is we're a modern cable network, you would say, for millennials. And we do lifestyle programming and food, home, travel, you know, getting into other categories like wellness and other things, which is pertinent to what we're doing here and what we did at Livestrong. But what we really do is we actually are reaching millennials in a modern way, many that don't have access to cable networks because it's expensive and they don't actually watch cable. They're on their phones and they're watching the new cable networks, which is Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram. And what we do is we provide content programming them in lifestyle categories, food and nutrition, home, travel, beauty, and other categories in the future. And we do it in a modern way. And I think that's super important to where digital health is going, because the younger generation isn't going to get their digital health information the same way that we all did.
Yeah.
And so that's something that's exciting. So the combination of those two things really helps me in terms of our strategies and how we think about bringing digital health into a modern age for a much younger audience.
Right.
That is a very large audience.
Right.
But I spent the first 10 years of my career in video games, really focused on online video games too, which was the whole concept around people playing games with each other. Not so much just, you know, linear gameplay by themselves, but really playing games with each other, which to some extent was the predecessor to social networking today and to all of the things you see with massive networks of people all over the world, you know, really combining together. The only difference was that it was the content at the time was video games, and the content now could be a photo on Instagram, or it could be something you post on Facebook, or it could be something in Snapchat. Whatever it is, the construct is still the same. People like to talk to each other and gather around content, you know, and it doesn't matter where you are today because everybody has a smartphone. And so we're seeing that is a little bit of a predecessor or foreshadowing to what is happening today in digital health. And just a little bit of history of where I first met Dr. Saxon. We had started a health and fitness site called livestrong.com. So we had partnered with the Lance Armstrong Foundation.
The yellow wristbands.
Exactly. Yeah. And they were focused really on cancer and cancer advocacy and all that. And what we were doing together is we said, you know, why don't we create a site that's more focused around wellness and healthy living that could actually be a complement to livestrong.org, which was, again, focused on cancer. So for us, we really wanted to help people stay healthy in the day-to-day so they didn't, you know, get chronic disease, whether it's cancer, diabetes, or any of these other diseases. And so that community and content that we created around that whole experience was really kind of something that, you know, we needed somebody that had a real credibility in the space, the medical space, to be a partner with us. And Dr. Saxon became our chief medical officer.
Okay.
So that's when I first met her. And then, you know, shortly after that, I became a board member of the Center for Body Computing. And every year, as you know, we have this conference called the, you know, Body Computing Conference, and where we bring together all the thought leaders to talk about all of the new revolutions and innovations in digital health specifically. So our mission really is to use technology to make healthcare more affordable and accessible for everyone. And, you know, those words are very important because affordable, accessible doesn't mean that everybody can get to a doctor. So if you think about the concept of digital, we really want, are really innovating on things like telemedicine and virtual doctors and all the different things that, you know, you kind of hear startups doing, but really hasn't totally come to fruition yet.
Yeah. And so one thing that we hear sometimes about, you're talking about digital health. We also talk about driving engagement through things like gamification and really trying to get people to get involved in their health. What did you learn when you were working at Livestrong, which became a cultural phenomenon that you've been able to bring to the advancement of digital health and engagement?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think really there really is like a simple system, and it works repeatedly over and over. And I think that's why I mentioned earlier my background in games. I had no idea how important that was going to be, because it isn't just about the subtle gamification of things. It's the actual combination of games, but with people. So again, my focus in my early career was online video games, not just video games. Right. So we had actually created these worlds and this content around the game is what makes you keep coming back. And then the community is what makes it different every time and what makes it compelling and what makes people, you know, really kind of learn from each other. So those two components, content itself, and then I'll draw the analogies to what the content is in digital health, but content with community, and then this kind of concept of a killer app. And the killer app at the time, again, was the game itself, right? And then the chat bot or the chat, you know, the chat room you were in, and all the kind of framework that created the world for you to exist in, right? So the killer app in this world is, you know, at Livestrong, we just kind of replicated that. You know, this is like 20 years later. We said, how could we not just gamify health, but how could we make it feel like something that is has those three components? So it's content, community, and a killer app, right? So the content itself at the time for Livestrong, we didn't focus on, you know, the .org was focused on, you know, cancer. We focused on nutrition and fitness.
Right.
And the reason we did that is because we felt that is those two things alone are the most can incredibly impact, you know, chronic disease. And that's, you know, better than any drugs or anything after. It's really what can you do before so you don't get into these states, right?
Yeah.
So for us, content was important. And at the time, content was a combination of articles about how to do things, how to live your life a certain way. It was recipes. But it was also just simply content as a nutrition label.
Right.
The label itself was where people were actually coming to us every day saying, how much fat or how much, you know, carbohydrates does this particular dish have? And then they would come and we would allow them to track if they ate that or not. And then they got into this kind of gamified construct where they, you know, all successful games are based on these concepts of core loops. You do something, you execute it, and then you get some, you know, you get some reward, and you just keep repeating. That's where the dopamine release comes from.
Right.
So we did that with the simple concept of content they were seeking, and then we put it into this concept of tracking your calories and tracking your fitness, and that loop was repeated multiple times a day, and then all of a sudden you start to achieve, but you don't like to achieve by yourself. So if you don't quickly surround these people with a community of like-minded people to support them and for them to, you know, also mentor, then it just breaks down, then the game's not fun anymore.
Right.
So we quickly had the community come in, and people were able to go through their own journey. But then once they got through the journey, they were able to say, you know what, I'm going to now be a mentor, but if I don't have a community, I can't point my, you know, learnings at anybody. So that's how it happened. And then that mechanic turned into, you know, now I think it's over 50 or 70 million people a month coming to Livestrong to this day. But that's a pretty big, you know, community of people doing that. And that's really kind of where we see digital health. It has to be something where you're giving, there's value exchange, but there's real progress that people can make, you know, because they have the ability to, you know, affect their health in a day-to-day manner, not something where you come in and 6 months ago later you're like, oh, I'm sick.
Right.
No, it's not about that. It's about what are you doing every day not to get sick.
Sure. So as far as today at the conference, you're speaking about digital health cars. Can you just tell us a little bit about how that plays into the center's mission?
Yeah. So that was interesting because some of these things are surprisingly connected to health, and you don't know it until it's presented to you. So this is something that Dr. Saxon and the team have been working on for many years. I think one of the first things they did was a study with BMW and equipping a Mini Cooper with sensors in it that, you know, health sensors, like, you know, EKG, you know, like being able to read your heart rate and doing all these things, but then not just doing those things in isolation, saying, hey, you've got a, you know, your heart's beating X per beats per minute. That's right. That's okay information. But what's more okay or more interesting is taking that information and applying it to something that can be useful. So what they were doing back then was applying it to like literally affect the ambient sounds and music in the car.
Right.
So if your heart was racing a little bit because of some stress in traffic, they'd change the radio station and put it on some, you know, different music or put on a different type of music, and it would start to calm you. And you can see today there's a lot of those things that the big car manufacturers are integrating, and even right. more like things like, you know, deploying certain aromatherapy at a certain
right,
time.
Right.
I mean, it's really pretty amazing stuff, right? So that was the initial kind of work that she had done. But then we had, over the years, have been working with other companies that are now more progressively focused on that as a core application for differentiation in their cars, right?
Yeah.
So for example, you know, many people who commute, they're in a car a long time, right? And one of the things we just thought simply was, what kind of data could you collect on people who were literally stationary for 3 hours in a car?
Yeah.
And, you know, O2 sensors and just heart rate and all these different things that you could put in a car. But you would have to actually have to know what you're collecting to do something with it. But,
yeah.
but we thought that is almost like think of it like a persistent, non-invasive, and not horrifying doctor visit
right.
every day. So imagine, you know, you go to a doctor when you're sick and it's not the best experience, but now you're driving in your car and over 30 days, over 90 days, we've collected so much more data than you would have just had at that point visit.
Excellent. Well, hey, Joe, thanks so much for sitting down with us. Best of luck at the rest of the conference today.
All right. Thanks a lot.
And now my interview with Ryan Capretta, founder and director of Proactive Sports Performance. All right, Ryan, thanks so much for sitting down with me. As we kind of get started here, you have a really unique background. Do you mind telling us a little bit about your background and what you do now?
Sure, yeah. So my background played college football, went to undergrad for exercise physiology, got my master's in exercise science, and then started on the team side. You know, so I worked for the Baltimore Ravens back in 2000 when we won the Super Bowl.
I was going to say, I see the
Got the ring. And then from there, moved on to Stanford University. And that was a cool experience because I was able to work with different populations of sports,
yeah.
Not just football and basketball players. So that really opened my eyes to training and how do you train different types of people for different goals. And then from there, went back to the NFL and worked for the Arizona Cardinals for 3 years. And then after that, started Proactive and out here in Southern California, moved back home and been doing that about going on 13 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that we look at is there's not one answer or one set and rep scheme or workout routine for everybody. So everybody's a little different, you know, from their injury background or their genetics that they're made up of or what motivates them. So that's something that we take a lot of pride in, is the individualized approach.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about Proactive really quickly? Is it mostly training like athletic training, or is it mostly like performance training?
Yeah, good question. So it's really mostly performance training. Mm-hmm. And we look at that from so many different angles. You know, there's so many spokes on the wheel. But yeah, it's performance training and, again, specialized really for athletes. But we've taken that and brought that to the adult population, the high school population. And realistically, it's a smart way to train.
Yeah. And so how did you get involved with the conference here? There was a really interesting conversation this morning about health data and who owns it and a whole really wide-ranging conversation. But how did you get involved?
Yeah, so years ago, we actually met Dr. Saxon through my mom, Tammy Capretta. She's worked here at the university for over 20 years. And so an intro through my mom. But then we worked with her for our combine group. And, you know, the combine training basically is the college kids coming out, getting ready for the draft, getting ready for the combine. And It's a big lab experiment, right? They dissect the players on all kinds of levels. The cool part for us working with Dr. Saxon is we've done some studies with her and the group, and it's a very controlled setting, you know, so you have these athletes, you have them all day, you know, so they're not coming in and out. You have them for a set period of time. And so that's what started the relationship is looking at combine training.
Yeah. And so there was some interesting conversation about how a lot of times sports data or sports health is kind of a microcosm of healthcare or how things start here. What are kind of your thoughts on how that ties into this healthcare conference?
Yeah, I mean, you know, from us, we look at how a person moves. You know, so for us, biomechanics are very important.
Right.
And with athletes and with general population, especially now with CrossFits and different things popping up, people overload themselves in a very unhealthy manner. And what happens is if you don't have the right mobility in your hip or you're not activating the right muscle and you put a greater load on your body, that's where injury occurs.
Yeah.
So whether it's athlete or just general population, movement is really the foundation for us of everything.
Sure. So as technology advances, what are some of the, on the positive side, what's some of the potential that you see as you're training athletes for collecting data or being able to analyze some of the body mechanics?
Yeah, so we look at a couple things. You know, one is there's different devices out there for muscle activation. You know, so we've used a company called Athos, and it's allowed us to look at sequencing and imbalances. You know, so if somebody, for instance, very basically can't activate their glute, there's issues with that. You know, and it helps us look at the people and find imbalances and ultimately correct their movement patterns, add specific exercises that will help them instead of just saying, hey, go stretch your hamstrings, everybody.
Right.
You know, so there's tools like that. And then you know, looking at things basically like heart rate, you know, and training in specific zones. And, you know, the foundation of any exercise program is progressive overload.
Right.
So these tools allow us to see where somebody comes in at their baseline numbers, and it gives us just another tool to allow to progress them in a safe manner.
Yeah. And where do you see most of the efforts in technology and collecting this data going towards performance enhancement or protection? Like there was some talk of things like concussions or, you know, knee injuries, things like that. Where do you see some of the focus coming?
You know, I think it's probably more performance based, but I think a byproduct of it will be protection on a lot of levels, you know, whether it's muscular, whether it's cardiovascular. I think if you are whoever's administering that, you know, depending on what lens you're looking through, I think that data will allow both of those sides to really evolve.
Yeah. One of the things I didn't expect to be such a hot topic of the panel today was data ownership. Actually, it was kind of focused on the risk of all of this collection of data today, and I wasn't expecting that. And you had mentioned that some of the athletes that you train, you collect a lot of data, and you have for many years. Can you give just kind of a really high-level overview of what is really kind of a new challenge and a new kind of frontier and what people are worried about?
Right. Yeah. So what I look at for our side on the private side is it's the relationship with the individual and the athlete. And it can be used in a couple ways. The first thing is that relationship of the athlete and the team.
Yeah.
And if they have that trust level, then we're happy to share that data. If the athlete, if it's going to help them, especially the transition from off season to in season.
Yeah.
If we can prescribe that data that we've used and share that, it's going to help the athlete.
Sure.
You know, and that's where the communication and the relationship, that's what we found is to be key. Now, it's also on the flip side. We've had some athletes that we've found some different challenges that they've had, whether it's injuries or coming off some different imbalances, and they don't want to share that information. So we give them the tools to say, okay, you're not sharing this with your team, but you still need to correct this.
Right.
So we try to kind of navigate through that, and it's challenging sometimes.
Yeah. Just before I let you go here, so you train athletes at the highest level. You also train, you know, athletes at lower levels, and also you have some work with just kind of, I guess, lay people or the general population. So how do you see, I mean, I think we talked a lot about how at the highest level, some of this data collection can help and some of this technology can help. How do you see it trickling down to, you know, me, or there was some talk about just an elderly population? How do you see some of that translating from elite athletes down to normal people?
Yeah, I think, in my opinion, it's looking at overuse.
Yeah.
You know, so with athletes and general population, if somebody's, whether they're wanting to get into a training program, whether they, you know, they've just went to the doctor and it's like, hey, you need to start exercising.
Right.
Well, I think that's where you look at educating, you know, and showing somebody, hey, don't overdo it.
Yeah.
And it's the same with our athletes. You know, we work with Albert Pujols, who's had years of just grinding his body. So we want to get him in shape, but we want to ultimately protect his joints. So it's the same thing with the general population is, whether you have to look at that experience level of exercise where they're at. And give that person the right roadmap to say, hey, here's what's going to help you. Because a lot of times people hurt themselves exercising.
Right.
And that's where I think the correlation between athletics and general population comes is if we can provide a better roadmap for people that don't really have that educational background, or, you know, it's intimidating to go in a gym, right? A lot of times it's like, that's the biggest thing where people won't exercise. So if we can give them tools to say, hey, get out, here's what you can do with zero equipment. You can do this at a park, but it's got to be progressive in nature, and it's got to be at the right level to that current status of where that person is.
Yeah. And then just last thing before I let you go, you said something interesting about how the equipment has to be as elite as some of the athletes that you work with are. If it changes, obviously their body is, you know, their their vehicle to, you know, success. What does that mean? Is that as far as like when you're actually wearing it, it has to work right, or it just has to be seamless with what they do?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's got to be seamless, you know, because they don't have any patience, you know. And then the other thing is we're limited on our time sometimes. So when these players are in season, they might just have like a 30-minute window to do their strength training.
Sure.
And if this device takes, you know, 5-10 minutes to get loaded and set, they're not going to do it.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's all about the user experience. And then from there, the byproduct of what they're getting. So if they spend the time to put this on and it's not useful information,
sure,
the athlete is going to be turned off and they're not going to really want to do it.
Sure. Hey, yeah. Thank you so much for sitting down with us. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
This is my conversation with Harel Kadesh, former CTO at GE Digital. Well, thank you so much for sitting down with me. I really appreciate it. I know you just finished up your panel. As we've been asking everybody who's been a guest so far today, can you give us a little bit of an idea of your background over the years and kind of what brought you to this point?
So I ran the mobile business for Microsoft in the 90s. I since then went to run a telematics company for Ford and Qualcomm, joined EMC and VMware. Ran a bunch of companies. The last one was acquired by GE, and I became the CTO for GE Digital. And for the last 2 years, I've been my job has been a partner at Silver Lake. So Silver Lake is a big private equity firm that invests in technology.
Sure.
And technology-enabled companies.
Sure. So. And so with GE, and you said about the CTO, was that on their interconnected devices that you were focused mostly on? Or how was there a common theme that ran through your technology experience?
Yeah. So at the time, the thesis was that data is being generated in volume.
Right.
And unlike data that people generate either on Facebook or, mails that they write or tweeting that they're doing, the data from the machines, coming from the machine, was not properly edited, normalized, curated, and then used to forecast problems. So if you think about that, there is a certain telltale signs in a turbine where if you don't catch them, the turbine may degrade performance.
Sure.
The idea was to capture the data, and those machines never sleep. They work 24/7. And if you can find or develop the machine learning algorithm to understand what's going on, then the idea is that you'll be able to save what we call unplanned downtime, which means that, you know, when a plane is sitting on the tarmac and the captain said, I cannot fly the plane, that's an unplanned downtime.
Right.
When you have a power outage, that's an unplanned downtime. And the whole thing is also has become much more relevant for healthcare than you know, you would be assuming, you know, without any prior knowledge, because you can actually take today an MRI image and train the machine to look at MRI images. And even if the radiologist is not looking at that specific part of the picture, the machine will look at everything.
Sure.
And while machine cannot practice medicine, machines can give you or the radiologist an idea or a kind of a notification to look at something and investigate a little bit further.
Yeah. So for the lay people of us who are listening, do you, on a very, very basic level, is that just by feeding so much information into those machines that it learns, it like actually learns what to look for? Or are you identifying certain things that you might see in an MRI that the machine would might notice that a physician might not?
So three things happened in the machine learning world in the last, let's say, 60 years since Marvin Minsky wrote his paper at MIT in the, you know, I think it was in the 50s. The power of hardware became so amazing that things that would be simply, you know, unimplementable today are reality. I mean, the processor in your phone is better than all the IBM 360 combined that existed in during the 70s, right? So this is one thing. The second thing is that the idea is that those algorithms, the more you train them, the more, in our case, images they see, the smarter they are. Right. And so they can cut the amount of information or the amount of processing to a fraction of the time and give a radiologist, you know, that is, his career is all about that, some pretty informed ideas about where he or she should look for signs.
Yeah. So how does this all tie into the body computing? How does all of your experience and all of your knowledge tie into body computing?
So simply put, if you look at, it depends how you interpret body computing. If you interpret body computing as a bunch of sensors that today or in the future will be on people's person, and you get the information, you can imagine there's going to be tons of information that is going to come in, and you'll need to understand, you know, where the data is, you know, is noisy. I mean, maybe the reading was not correct. There was too much humidity in the air. There was not enough contact. There was some, you know, the machine for some reason did not read it properly. So you filter out all the spurious data, and then you're left with, you know, data that presumably can belong to tens or hundreds of millions of people.
Right.
And the question is, can you use your knowledge about the overall population to decide what is normal, what is abnormal, even in the setting of you and I? You know, I can have a heart rate, for me, a heart rate of 140 may be abnormal. For you, 140 is just slight exertion, right? So it's the same size doesn't fit all.
Sure.
And the machine can actually develop a pretty pervasive view, not just of the canonical model, the average one, but on the individual one, because not only they take hundreds of millions of people, they also take many millions of readings from you only.
Yeah.
So, you know, all those readings from you and then all the readings from everybody should allow the machine to get itself trained on what is the right thing for you.
Yeah. There was a lot of talk earlier about ownership of personal data. It started with the sports conversation, and it's kind of threaded throughout the day. How are those conversations happening with some of the things that we're talking about here and some of the things that you talked about on your panel, where maybe it's not an athlete in performance in that way, but maybe it's a wearable that is recording my just everyday health data or heart rate, but if that is being communicated somehow to a physician or things like that, how are those conversations happening right now?
So everybody's falling into this HIPAA problem, right? That the data is mine and mine alone, and I should not give it to anybody. But let's apply some common sense tests to that.
Right.
If I could give that my data to somebody who could actually keep me healthier for a longer period of time, probably there should be a way for me to approve it.
Right.
Correct.
Right.
And I believe that if you know there are certain things that you can do that by and large will allow you to get that. Now, this is not a completely risk-free environment.
Sure.
Somebody may get hold of your data. We can protect as much as we can, but you know, even today we see that Facebook has lost quite a few millions of its users got breached.
Right.
So those things are going to happen from time to time. We should not be casual about them, should not be complacent about them, but we should not lose the forest from the trees here, the trees from the forest. At the end of the day, if I get the data to somebody who's qualified to help me, I would like to do that. There's going to be a risk that we need to minimize. But I don't think, let's not throw the baby with the bathwater.
Right. Not to mention that people willingly are sending their DNA off to be read by the
Everybody. I mean, it's a culture for exhibitionism. So everybody would like to talk about what they ate for breakfast. But, you know, there are certain things that fall into the trap, not because necessarily they're not willing to give it to other people, but because there is a bunch of systems and people that will make the decisions for them.
Right.
right? I mean, I cannot get sometimes my own information from my hospital because my hospital is not willing to violate any HIPAA compliance, but it's my data.
Right, right.
Right?
Right. And so before I let you go here, thank you again for sitting down with me. But you've had a wealth of experience over many different industries. Besides the HIPAA challenge, what are some unique challenges with technology in healthcare?
I think that one is that, you know, if you really want to deal with digital health, you have to build enough sensors that will go with people everywhere. And, you know, obviously, if you don't think it through, you can get to the point where it's socially unacceptable. People are going to go with a plethora of devices on them. It's going to be, you know, unimplementable, unrealizable, because people are not going to do that. So the question is, what are the areas that you think you can do in a certain setting, maybe a car or at home?
Right.
And what are the areas, what are the sensors that you believe will be able to accompany the person throughout their their journey in life, right? 24/7. And obviously, if you need to measure glucose absorption and the person has diabetes, he or she may be even open to, to do some awkward things in order to get the data. The other part is really, especially if this is real-time medicine, then you have to think about how you move the bits around. And this is something that wireless communication and the evolution of wireless communication can help us a great deal. But, you know, in order to make sure that the data does not bleed into unauthorized agents, you have to make sure that there is enough technological advances in wireless data, in miniaturization of sensors, in machine learning algorithm. So all these things is coming together. Whether it's gonna happen next year or in the next 10 years, I don't know.
Right.
But these are the challenges that you have to work on.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time and sitting down with me today.
All right.
And now my conversation with Cyrus Shahibi, Chair of the Department of Computer Science at USC.
Cyrus, thank you so much for sitting down with me today at the conference. I know that your panel just finished here. I appreciate your time very much.
Sure.
As we start, and just so the audience knows, can you tell us a little bit about your background and kind of what brought you to this point?
Sure. I'm a professor of computer science. I'm also chair of the computer science department here at USC. My research area, the area of interest, is in data management and data analysis. What that means is basically we get excited when we see challenging data sets. And just the data being challenging is not enough. We actually need to have some real-world applications with societal impact where the data is useful to that application. So in the past, for example, my team, we were working in the area of the transportation. So we're looking at, in particular, traffic data that we're collecting from more than 15,000 sensors around LA County. That was a challenging data set because the data was coming at us every 30 seconds.
Right.
And we need to figure it out how to analyze the data and make sense of it, for example, for urban planning, for transportation policy, and so on. And then recently, we got excited about wearable data sets.
Yeah.
We realized there are a lot of common challenges within the data that we're dealing with in the area of transportation, and these wearable data sets are collected, for example, from your Apple Watch and Fitbit and so on. And the real-world application, of course, that we look into was health and medical applications. And in particular, we work with Dr. Saxon at the USC Body Computing Center for ECG data that now can be collected basically from your phone.
Right.
You put your fingers on a little bit of a device that is in the back of the phone, and it collects your ECG. And the question we were trying to address was that whether this data set potentially can replace the ECG data, for example, that is collected at clinic.
Yeah.
When you go in and they put all these leads on you and so on. So that's how we got excited about this project and started working. And that's my relationship to the center and to this panel.
Yeah. And so when you look at it, are you looking at how that data can be securely collected or accurately, or more how it can be sorted through and utilized once it's collected?
I think a little bit of all of these.
Yeah.
In a sense, the In particular for ECG data, we also look at other data sets. But in ECG data, when you go to the clinic, there's an expert there that basically put the leads on your body parts. Right. I mean, they know where to put it. They know exactly what should be the level of contact between the lead and your body. And then if things go wrong, they do it again, right? So they do it multiple times. Eventually, they get the correct measurements. But that's only for that 5 minutes or 2 minutes that you're in the clinic. But when you do it kind of randomly as people in an ad hoc way, as people put their phone and use their phone to collect data, the advantage is data is over longer period, right? Sure. So you might get more and more data sets over the days and weeks and so on. But the disadvantage is that there is no longer an expert there. So right. The data that is collected, for example, may be noisy, may be irregular, not exactly the quality of the data that you expect. So one part of this is to build software tools to make sure that the data that is collected is the quality that you want.
Right.
And then, of course, as you mentioned, once you collect the quality data, also we need to kind of store it, index it, manage it, access it fast, and then do the analytics on top of it to basically get to the point of what the expert really want to see from this data and what sort of things, what sort of a diagnosis, for example, they want to have using the data set that we collected.
How is looking at these large data sets and analyzing large data sets really innovating the healthcare industry? Because I know that there is a lot of healthcare data, but it hasn't always necessarily been analyzed efficiently.
Right.
So
right.
How is that really innovating as we move forward?
Right. So I think, as you mentioned, the efficient analysis is important. And it's not just the fact that the data is large. I mean, the large data sets by itself is not necessarily the challenge.
Sure.
The fact that data is coming to you at a streaming fashion, basically it's keep coming at you.
Yeah.
The fact that, as I mentioned, the data is noisy. The fact that you have no control on who provides the data, right? So, for example, in clinical trials, if you have a study, you have a research study, and basically you say, okay, I'm going to target people between age of such and such, I'm looking at male or female and so on. But in this case, it's multiple cohorts that collect the data, that the data is collected.
Sure.
From these guys, and you have no control on it. You get whatever you get, right?
Yeah.
So the challenges are not necessarily only the fact that it's large, but the fact that it's streaming, the fact that it's noisy, the fact that it's heterogeneous. These are the challenges with the data set. And the way that these gonna hopefully I should mention also a unique challenge with the health data is that it's private.
Right.
Right. So you need to make sure that in the process, I mean, you might anonymize the data and to the best of your ability, but still there might be certain things there that if you kind of reverse engineer, you can figure out who provided the data. You can maybe even identify the person.
Sure.
So these are basically the challenges that are unique to the health. And then the fact that the result of the analysis that a data scientist or a computer scientist might do might not necessarily be the one that a doctor would be interested in.
Right.
So there's a gap,
right?
And bridging that gap is also very important, that you need to have people with the skill sets that, of course, they have the data and computation literacy, but at the same time, they should be domain experts to understand what they should look into data, right?
Yeah. Well,
what for, not just that we do our typical analysis and suddenly, voila, some interesting results gonna go up.
Yeah. And so if or when you're successful, say with this project in particular, what opportunities does it present to analyze people's health both in real time and as populations or as trends over time?
Right. So the real-time aspect, I mean, there are certain things that you can immediately provide feedback to the patient. For example, that your heart rate is over certain threshold and you might calm down, or you haven't been exercising for a long time, maybe it's time for you to exercise, or there are certain things that we are looking at your ECG, and it's basically becoming troublesome, so you might want to go and see a doctor immediately or right. or in the next week or so. So there are some immediate real-time intervention
that could even ping on the phone.
Yeah, exactly. Right? So that's something that the your app suddenly tells you that you need to be careful or about what you're eating, what you're doing, your exercise level, or up to the point that it's time to see a doctor, for example, right? So that's the real-time aspect. The pattern aspect or collecting data across multiple people and looking at the patterns, you might start seeing correlations, for example, between certain type of disease and certain type of behavior, right? And then we might say, okay, so given this correlation, if I see somebody else coming in with this similar type of behavior over period of time, then I might, for example, start predicting that this kind of a disease is inevitable in the next couple of months or years. So maybe I should, for example, look at this patient more carefully and so on. Yeah. So that's another kind of like looking at the whole, at the pattern, not just that single patient.
Right. And so before I let you go here, what kind of realistic timeline can we expect on say an application like this on a phone?
Yeah, I mean, at like depends on the complexity. I would say simple things I can immediately see within the next like 6 months. You can build something that look at like single patient, for example, the real time aspect. That's easier because you just it's a kind of self contained app, right?
Right.
The sensor is on the patient. The app is there, so you just you just look at certain thresholds and then basically give some information intervention to the patient. That within a 6 month period, I would say that's doable. But the more challenging one is basically the one that you mentioned, the patterns and over across multiple patients, and that require more basically a back end database. Right. That collect the data for a long time, creating the models and the patterns and so on. And that I would say at least a couple of years until some reasonable results come out.
Excellent. Well, hey, thank you so much for sitting down with me today.
Thank you. Pleasure.
My final interview is with Peter Morgan, founder of Clever Security. Thank you so much for listening today.
All right, Peter, thanks so much for sitting down with me here at the conference. As we get started, can you tell me a little bit about your background and how you got into security and what you do?
Sure. So I started out as a kid because I wanted to learn how to hack video games and slowly learned that, got really interested in it because it was fun. And then, you know, studied computer science traditionally in college, but...
How do you hack video games? For those of us that don't know.
At the time... I was able to take apart some of the game files and then decompile them into a version of the C language and then slowly learn C by modifying components and having it not work and then fixing it. And then that was kind of a trial by error process. But that excitement of achieving that really got me hooked.
Yeah. And then did you study engineering in school?
Computer
science. How did you continue on that path there?
So it was mostly... At the time when I went to school, there wasn't really a demand for a security conscious program in college, but it was always an interest of mine that I was following up on and continuing with. And really all of the professional work I've done since I was 18 has been in security companies, ranging from research to consulting, and really the gamut of that.
Yeah. And so when you say security, you're not talking about like a security guard that you see walking around a premise. Can you tell people a little bit about what security means, whether it's consulting or with a company?
Sure. So typically, in a lot of ways, this companies interact with it now is larger companies may have an in-house security team that is charged with trying to defend their products and respond to incidents that happen. And the dynamic that we see most in the workplace is they will hire consulting companies or research companies to help augment their skill set where they either don't have the personnel or the background in doing that. And that's really where I've operated the majority of my time, as, you know, being hired to come in and, you know, emulate the attacker's mindset and attack the device exactly how they would and do that in advance of, you know, someone extorting them for money, for instance, and trying to fix those issues as quickly as possible.
Yeah. It's interesting. I actually was just reading an article about this, about how do you stay, rather than focusing on fixing problems that already happened, how do you not get bogged down in that and try to stay ahead of people who are trying to break in?
It's a very good question. So one of the a good example of that currently is the malware problem. So if you look at how malware exists, there's these giant organizations that will basically ingest every new executable file that's produced per day, and they try to scan them and look for things that may classify as malware. And then it, as you go deeper and deeper down that process, you start identifying new techniques that are used in exploitation. And exploitation is when someone finds a vulnerability in a piece of software and then can write code to exercise that vulnerability and take over control of a computer.
Sure.
So we can learn a lot about some of the new techniques that come out by observing what's in use in the wild. And then there is a pretty strong quasi-academic security research community that presents regularly at conferences and really advances the state of the art for vulnerability research, exploitation, defensive tactics. And we're actually seeing a shift now where large companies are driving the majority of the defensive research,
sure.
Which is, I think, a kind of a different spot for what it used to be.
Yeah. And so what do you do now? Do you do consulting or are you with that firm now?
So I have a small company called mm-hmm. Clever Security, and we do consulting and research. The majority is research, and we get hired to basically take things apart. Yeah. So someone will give us a device and we'll take it apart, identify all of the hardware components of it, take those off of the PCB, extract the code from them, reverse engineer that, identify issues, write exploits for it that demonstrate the issue to the product team.
Sure.
That can help our client drive change in their organization to fix those issues. And a lot of it ends up being something new I've never seen before,
yeah.
or you know, trying to identify new ways to hack into something that I'm not aware of. So it is a lot very research oriented, where the path you start down, you have an idea where the goal is, but how you get there, you're not necessarily sure.
Sure, sure. And so how does that tie into the conference today, into the body computing topic?
Sure. So with the proliferation of, like, you know, Internet of Things style devices, we have this trend of stapling computers into all sorts of things, shoes and watches. And, you know, people walk around with a number of devices that have computers in them.
Right.
We're starting to see this in cars, and there's been a lot of research into vehicle security. And with one of the goals of the body computing conference, talking about how integrating life care into cars, it's a particularly interesting topic, because if you look at the vehicle from 1970 versus the vehicle from 1990 versus today, you had something that was all machinery versus something that was on the edge of starting to get computers integrated, and to where today, where there is no linkage, mechanical linkage between how a car operates. It is all computer systems.
Right.
And we have to trust that when the engine gets the message that the accelerator was pushed, that the accelerator was actually pushed.
Right.
That's just a message, and we have to trust that. So integrating more technology in general increases the attack surface, and it causes another goal for an attacker that may want to do something malicious by having personal health information, or, you know, another good example is authentication data, because anytime there is personal health information on a device, you want to protect it and access it only to the right people. So how do you authenticate those? And if I stole those credentials, what could I do with them elsewhere outside of the car?
Right. That kind of thing. I think that this is a big topic. And before I let you go here, how does the benefit of a connected car like that and what it can do outweigh the security risks that you've kind of outlined here?
Well, I think there's a lot of opportunity for it. And I think that I'd never like to see security be at odds with product development.
Right.
They should be able to work together well. And I think that can happen, but it requires a better understanding of history than I've seen a lot of the product development companies operate with. And a good example of this is if you look at Windows in the early 2000s, they were getting beat up with security bulletins frequently and exploits for their code. And they made an organizational shift, and it took a long time for them to recover from that. And then if we fast forward to the modern smartphone era and you look at the design goals of Google's Android operating system versus Apple's iOS, Apple made a really tough decision early on to say, we're going to control every aspect of this. And that's going to allow it. One of the things we earn from that control is the ability to make this a lot more secure.
Yeah.
And if you just look at the numbers, the amount of malware for iOS devices versus Android devices is the orders of magnitude different.
Yeah.
And that's because of those design decisions. So I'd really encourage product developers to look at the history and make the design decisions early that say, let's integrate security into this the right way and be less hopeful that it's just going to work out.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Well, hey, thank you so much for sitting down with me and excellent luck on the panel this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.